Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Hey, good evening, everyone. John Henry Soto here, along with George Batista. Welcome to Counterparts. Very excited today. If you are a fan of acting, if you're a fan of writing, if you're a fan of The X-Files, this is the show to be watching. We have William B. Davis is on the show, and we're very excited to have him on here. So just hang out, get yourself some nice tea, sit back, and get ready for an awesome conversation. All right. Thank you, everyone, for joining us this evening. We are very excited. As you know, I sometimes tend to talk a little bit too much at the beginning of these things. George always yells at me, so I'm going to like chill out. We also have a sponsor that we want to introduce as well today, a new sponsor. So, George, I'm going to turn it to you and do your thing.
Thank you, sir. So first of all, I want to welcome our new sponsor. The Counterparts Show is brought to you by Wellness Resources, a family-owned and operated nutritional supplement company providing the highest quality clinically formulated supplements since 1985. So find out why Wellness Resources supplements are the top choice of health-conscious individuals around the world. Go to myvitaminresource.com. All right. So I'm going to introduce our amazing guest today. Today we have Mr. William B. Davis. William is a Canadian actor and director who has worked in stage and radio, but is probably best known for his role as the cigarette-smoking man on the hit sci-fi show The X-Files. Besides appearing in many TV programs and movies, he founded his own acting school, the William Davis Center for Actors. While continuing to act, he has recently returned to directing and has published two books, Where There's Smoke, Musings of a Cigarette Smoking Man in 2011, and On Acting and Life in 2022. He can currently be seen on the science fiction comedy television series Upload, and we are very, very excited to have him on this program. So without further ado, let's bring up Mr. William B. Davis.
All right.
Thank you, sir,
for being on. This is awesome. So as George, right before we started, George is a big fan. I'm a big fan, and we're just really honored and so happy to have you on the show. So thank you so much.
Yeah, great to be here. Thank you.
You're welcome. And as I said before, George is sort of like the, I'll say the professional when it comes to the questions. So we like to jump in, right, and start with the questions. And I think we have a comment here. We'll read that. We'll read any comments that we get. Somebody just says, "Hey, what's up? Hey, what's up, Dave?
All right, what's
Thank
up?
You very much." And we're going to get started with some questions. So, George, you want to give us your first question?
Yes, absolutely. Again, thank you so much for being on. And again, I've been a fan of yours in the series as well. And, you know, very much, you know, love your acting style and stuff. So what I like to do with my questions, I like to kind of start, you know, I like to kind of go back and hear the backstory. I know, you know, you were acting very, very young. And so I'd like to know, you know, what drew you to the profession, first of all, and because I know your parents weren't actors, right? Were your parents supportive of you being in acting?
Yes. They were great, actually, because they never pushed it. They never, I had some terrible experiences as a child with the mothers of other young actors.
Oh, really? Okay.
I never. My parents were always just fine in one way or the other. What brought it all together really was my cousins. They were second cousins and a half a generation older than I. Eventually they ran a major theater company in Toronto. But at the time when I was a boy, they were running a summer theater company in Ontario. And they imposed on my family to provide rehearsal space in Toronto before they went north. So they were rehearsing their seasons in the basement of our house.
Oh, wow.
And they also imposed on my father to provide legal advice to their summer company. So there was quite a connection there.
Yeah.
So this was all kind of going on, and lively things would happen in our basement, and we would have to explain to the neighbors that no, there wasn't a fight going on. And then in their second season, they were doing a murder mystery that needed a young boy. And so who was handy at the right age?
Yeah.
Me.
So, more imposing.
So there we go. I'd like to say there was a nationwide search to find the right actor, but they actually found very close by. But that's what got me started.
Oh,
that's awesome. That's convenient. those sounds, the sounds of the theater and the sounds of people rehearsing is always such a fascinating thing to hear, you know, especially when you're not really aware of what's happening, but you kind of feel like something energy is happening, especially when the writing is really good. Do you remember feeling that? Like seeing
in those days too, people were still kind of acting full out right from the time they got the script. I mean, now we do a more slow kind of developed growth stage, but they're kind of really jumping right in.
Yeah, okay.
So yeah, there'd be screams and shrieks and, but yeah, definitely an atmosphere and actors in and out of the house all the time. Of course, they were always phoning their agents, hoping they had a call or, you know, and because they were trying to find other work at the same time. And, yeah. You know, so one kind of grew up in that with that atmosphere, yeah. Not to, in any kind of sense of being starstruck, just that was a normal way that people lived, you know, so.
Did you know that you wanted to do that? At that point?
Not right away. Once I had done the role, the first role, after that, they gave me another role every summer few years. And then I found an acting teacher, and then the acting teacher arranged for me to get an audition on CBC Radio, this being before television or film in Toronto. And radio was really where actors worked.
Right.
And landed a part on a series, and for the first two or three years before my voice broke and they didn't care about me anymore, I was doing a lot of child acting on radio.
That's amazing. And during that era, there was, I guess, Bob Hope had a really popular radio show. There was, I think, Abbott and Costello had.
Oh, yeah.
Were you listening to all these?
I listen to radio all the time, and I listen to a lot of radio drama. I even kept a kind of catalog of the shows that I saw, which ones I liked, and which actors I liked, and then I had to schedule my homework kind of around the broadcast times. And, you know, in those days, they broadcast at a certain time. You couldn't just stream it. Wanted it.
I know.
Right at that moment.
Yeah.
So you had to organize your life around the broadcast time.
You know, that must be interesting, because I'm thinking that if you're on the radio and you're doing these, you know, these things on the radio, it kind of, it kind of trains you differently, because you have to, you know, nobody's watching you. They're just hearing your voice, right? So you have to project all this, but just through your voice versus people actually seeing your expressions and things like that, right?
Yes, exactly. It's funny. I don't know if we thought about it. Well, I lie. Some of the really experienced radio actors were very, very conscious of how their voice was sounding.
Right.
And they had a complicated way of delineating their expressions and so on in their script and so on. So yes, you had to be, it really attuned your ear.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, I often say I have a real ear for acting and for when actors are true or not true. And maybe it started from doing that much radio at the beginning. That's what, and also listening to it as well as doing it, you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, I would think that also with the voice, you have to not only, you have to create that image for the audience,
right,
with your, you know, with your actual inflections and, you know, you have to really, they're not seeing an image. It, you have to create that image for them.
Yeah, it's not so complicated. I mean, if it's well written, you put, you do what actors always do. You put yourself in the imagined situation and you live truthfully in that situation. But it does, the quality of your voice does make a difference. I love the man, but David Duchovny has a rather flat voice. I'm not sure he'd be that great on radio. I remember listening
to right.
One of his, the French actor who dubbed him, for instance, had a much more electric voice, and it was kind of see that in David's face. but yes, you had to have a certain kind of a voice, I think, because if you're kind of just too kind of flat all the time, mind you, there was, who was the actor who played Dragnet? Just the fact, man. That was right.
I can't remember his name now, but that's true. Yeah. He had that type of tone. But you know, it's funny because you said the writing, and really the write, it's so important, just the right to have good writing, no matter what the medium is.
Exactly.
It's
like, exactly.
You have to have good writing.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's amazing.
So did you do anything other than acting, or did you have any other jobs or anything like that, or was it just acting?
I had a paper route for six weeks. My brother had a big long paper route and he made a lot of money on it. I was delighted that my paper route, I had to give up my paper route because I got a radio show.
Oh, okay.
That recorded in the morning and I couldn't do the paper. So I had to give that up. So I had a paper route for a while. Then I did maybe 3 weeks in the kitchens at a racetrack. That didn't last very long. And once when I was in England, I sold advertising space and when I was out of work. But pretty much I've always worked in some form of the profession.
Wow.
And it was Jack Webb.
That's right, Jack Webb. Yes.
Make sure the audience doesn't get that. So I'm fascinated to hear about the transition from the radio to television, because that was such a big thing just in the world in general, just when that first thing happened. It's almost like what the internet was when it came out in the late 90s. I don't think it was that extreme, because I think television hit like day one, and it was then day two it was there, and it was just a really, really big part of the world. How was that for you? Because I know a lot of actors that were on radio had trouble.
It was actually fascinating, because when I was a boy when I was doing radio acting, so it wasn't really going to affect me directly. Mm-hmm. But I watched the older actors, and you know, we had the CBC radio building on Jarvis Street in Toronto, and there was a fire escape out the back, and if you went up that fire escape you could see this yellow building being built across the just across the way, and that was a television building. The radio actors would look at that and they would wonder, you know, whether this was a breakthrough of hope for them or this was the end of the road.
Interesting.
And it was a bit of both. Some of it was the end of the road, and for some they blossomed and became successful actors on screen. I mean, Robert Goulet, for instance. The other names will come to me of people who really came through that and worked out well. But
yeah, and it must have been also kind of the same thing when it went from the talkies
from the talkies,
a lot of actors, I think the film Singing in the Rain kind of covers that in a very comical way of how some of these actors that looked great on screen when they weren't talking, but then when they were talking, they were like, hello, guys, you know.
Yeah.
And it kind of ended careers for a lot of people.
Well, and I, the reverse probably happened from radio to television. They sounded beautiful until you saw their face. So.
Right, exactly.
It's like, so you have the face for radio kind of deal.
Now, I know that you also, through your journey, you worked under Olivier, right? Sir Laurence Olivier?
Yes.
And how was that? And what did you learn from him?
Well, I have to caution that slightly. I worked in his company.
Oh, okay. It was his company.
I did not work directly with Lawrence.
Okay.
The company, the National Theatre Company at the time of UK, was divided into two parts. There had two sections, a company A and a company B. They were equally important.
Sure.
But they had two theatres and they would rotate back and forth. So Olivier was always, gentleman that he was, in company B.
Oh, okay.
And I was always in company A.
Right.
I worked with some great people, Maggie Smith, Laurence, Albert Finney.
Albert Finney. Wow, yeah, he's one of my favorites.
But I did not work directly. With Sir Laurence. I mean, I was there for company meetings when he gave talks and things like that.
Yeah. That's great.
Was he... how was he as a man, you know, because you as a manager sort of?
He was actually a pretty good manager. He has such a big presence on stage or film, but in real life, he's a smallish man a smallish man and not very prepossessing.
Interesting.
As his wife said, he could take the subway to work and nobody recognized him.
Wow. That's
amazing. But he was very, very fair, very, very organized, very ambitious, I think. But that part I didn't see so much of. I've read about it since, but at the time I didn't see that. It seemed like a well-run enterprise. Yeah.
So I want to talk about the Coming to America, not the film Coming to America with Eddie Murphy, but do you remember when you actually first came to America? Was it for a job?
For America as opposed to Canada, you mean?
Yeah.
Correct.
Because sometimes we were talking about the United Kingdom, so. Mm-hmm.
Right.
The first time I was in the U.S., I've often been in the U.S. to ski, but that's another matter. The first time I worked, I directed a production of The Winter's Tale in Vermont. Spear Festival. And I'm trying to think what other kind of theater things I might have done. I guess the biggest jump was, of course, when X-Files moved from Vancouver to Los Angeles.
Okay.
And then I was back I guess it's not the Big Apple. New York's the Big Apple, but I was, what do you call Los Angeles? It's the,
these days there's a lot of names, but
I used to go to New York frequently to see theater when I was at university. I would go regularly and saw some great work. Paul Newman in Tennessee Williams and Geraldine Page and the first West Side Stories. I mean, I saw the first season. I went back to see it the second season, and I was so hooked. And in London, I went to see it the next year in London. Then I went to see it the next year in London, and then I went to see the movie. So 5 years in a row, I did my West Side
Story. You know every note.
And I love the recent movie. Actually, the recent movie West Side.
Oh yeah.
Story. Well done. Very well done. Good. I mean, now, you know, it's interesting because, you know, John and I talk about this a lot as musicians, right? We're, you know, playing live in a show versus like being in a studio, you know, for actors, maybe being on a stage versus being, you know, in a television studio or a movie studio. So is theater like your number one? Is that your favorite or do you like them equally or what?
It's hard to say, and it depends whether we're talking about acting or directing too.
Either one.
I mean, I love directing for the theater because we didn't kind of skipped over that a little bit, starting as a boy actor, but then eventually I went to the University of Toronto thinking I was going to be an actor and ended up finding I was directing, and I was directing more and more and more and became more and more involved as a theater director. And I actually went to England to study acting to help me as a theater director. That was really my
That's interesting.
And then I worked in Britain for several years as a theater director. And so I, you know, I've worked in both media. So if it's a question of directing, I think I prefer directing in the theater to directing in film, although I've done both. Mostly because of the involvement. You know, when you direct, well, you work in film at all, as you know, you wait a lot. The other guy has to do their bit while you wait. In the theater, when you're certainly when you're directing, you know, they come in and start rehearsal, and you work all day until the rehearsal's over.
Right. There's no waiting.
You might get a coffee break, but that's you know, wait for. Stage management have set up the rehearsal before you got there, and then you just go. I mean, it's different when you get into the tech rehearsal and stuff, but that's a kind of transitional stage, and then the show opens, and then you're useless after that.
Right.
So there's that problem too.
And you sit in the back.
So there's the other side of it, which is, of course, that the director in film and television can work on the material after you've shot it, and you can do all sorts of things with it. And that terrible scene that that actor never got right, you can, well, you just kind of eliminate it from the whole show if you have to, right? Or you can find some way around it. I mean, the transition was was the most obvious for me in radio, because I had worked as a radio actor, as we've been talking about, when it was live, when everything you did went straight into the living room of the listener. There was nothing recorded. Even the sound effects were done live. Everything was done live. 20, 30 years later, I went back. I was hired to direct radio drama. I went as a producer, director at the CBC for radio drama for 2 or 3 years. And it was completely different. None of it was live. We were making it the way you make a movie. We would record the sound, and we would do different takes, and we'd do that. And then we'd edit the sound together. And then we'd add in or edit the voice track together. And then we'd edit and in the sound effects. And then we'd record the music. And then we'd do a mix, you know, just as if we were making a movie. But it was completely different from what we did as a...
Wow. Did you have... when you're editing for film, do you... not editing for film. When you're directing for film, do you think as an editor also, understanding how things go together?
Yes, you have to.
I find that that's really important as a director.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, a good editor will add to that that you might not have or seen, but yes, you have to have. I never used a storyboard very much, a little bit with a storyboard, but always you have to have an idea of how it's going to cut together, I think.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I think also when you're directing for, you know, any film or anything, you know, the magic of it is that you can do that editing later on, and then you can go back and kind of tweak it and mess around with it and try to make it go to whatever the vision is. Whereas, you know, the theater, it has to be your direction right at the beginning. It's got to be spot on, because that's what it's going to be. The blocking is going to be what it is, and nobody's going to go change anything unless they mess up or something. But
I mean, it will evolve through the rehearsal process, once you're up there, you're up there. You can't fix it up, you know.
I'm sorry, George. I'll let you ask.
Go ahead. Go right ahead.
But I'm fascinated by theater directing, because there's got to come a point where you say, "That's it, that's the piece," and maybe a little tweaks here and there, but we've worked through everything. We've got the blocking down. We've got, you know, all the angles covered. The story flows, and I'm giving this, like, we're ready to go. Do you get to that point, or is it always opening
night? You're like, about a work of art, But it's never finished. It's just a point where right. you actually have to let it go.
Right.
Yeah, same thing with film.
But there is that. There is what for me was the last kind of stage was in as the show developed before you went finally into tech things. So it was there, but it was a little loose. And I would always think, now I go with my screwdriver. I get my screwdriver and I start tighten here, close the gaps. And then it would come alive because it was sinking in the gaps. And then, but yes, once it's up and there, that's it.
Yeah. I mean, even I saw an interview with Scorsese where he says that, you know, he looks at Goodfellas today and he still says, I should have done this, or I should have done that, or and I'm like, let it go.
My book yet? But I've been rewriting my book ever since I published it.
That's right. So we're gonna get to one question from Jordan, and I actually want to talk about your book because that's really interesting.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to know. How did the actual X-Files come about?
For me.
Yeah, for you. How did they approach you with the series?
They didn't.
Oh, okay.
Interesting. I will explain.
Sure.
I was a working actor in Vancouver. Well, I was mostly a working acting teacher because I had my school. That was really where my main focus was at that time. But I would go in for auditions for stuff from time to time. And so they called me in for this show about alien abduction, which I thought, well, that's not going to go very far. But anyway. So they had me read for the senior FBI agent in the audition. He has three lines. And I don't know how well you might remember the pilot, but in the pilot, Scully's being interviewed by the head of the FBI.
Right.
And he's got two guys sitting beside him at this table. And one of them is this senior FBI agent who actually has three lines. The cigarette smoking man who was leaning against a cabinet in the background and had no lines. So I got the part with no lines. My friend Ken Camero got the part with the lines.
Wow.
We've laughed about that a lot over the years. I've laughed longer than he has.
Right.
Because who knew? Who knew where that was going?
Exactly.
And who knew if they were? I mean, obviously, when you audition someone, you have to attach them to something. They have to do something. So they maybe had me in mind for that non-speaking role right from the beginning.
Right.
But they just needed to see me do something. Or it may be that I failed. Second best. I don't think so, though. I don't think so. But anyway, I knew nothing more about it than that. When we were shooting it, I was directing a show with my school. I was didn't think too much about this. Of course, I had no idea that this would become a popular show. Really, aliens.
And you thought it was just a one and done thing, right?
I think I knew it was a pilot, but I didn't think the pilot would get picked up.
Right.
Anyway, the pilot got picked up. My character did not appear to get picked up. They shot for months and weeks. It wasn't until late in the first season that I came back to do a very small little bit. And then it wasn't until towards the end of the first season that I actually had a line or two and had some presence. But it was in season two when Morgan and Wong wrote an episode called One Breath, with a really dynamic scene between the smoking man and Mulder.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the turning point, really. At the time, Bob Goodwin talks about this all the time because he's was a producer on the show, and he actually directed that episode. And he had no idea whether I could act or not. He said, "Oh my God, look at this scene! But can Bill Davis act?" Of course, I had a resume and I had a demo reel, but he hadn't looked at that. he's become a good friend, and we've talked about it since. But he was so relieved once we started, because he was delighted with what happened, and they were delighted. And then so the character got more and more interesting. And then the fans got interested in the character.
Right.
Right. Exactly. Back in these early days of the internet, you know, they would meet Friday night and they would talk to each other and they would imagine things and whatever. And so the character became interesting, as well as the whole series became interesting. None of this might have happened nowadays, because if you don't have a hit right off the bat, you don't last very long.
Exactly.
Right. This had an opportunity to grow with its audience, and the young internet helped that.
And it's funny, because I love the concept of the mysterious character, and I didn't want them to kind of give you any more of a backstory or you know, because I was like, no, because then you take the mystery out of this character, and I like that. So I was hoping they wouldn't, like, you know, show your childhood and this whole thing.
Love interest or something.
Exactly.
And then they sort of did, but then they didn't with this.
Right, exactly.
The so-called musings of a smoking man, because that really wasn't the backstory at all.
Right, right.
I don't think. I mean, people think it was, but we didn't.
Right, exactly.
So we're going to, I feel like we're shooting out of sequence, as they say. But I kind of want to talk. I want to talk about your school. I want to talk about what was the, you know, how you started. Obviously, I want to talk about your book on acting and life, which you can anybody can, you know, can get this on your website as well, right? And it's so what was that like? What was, you know, putting this together with that? I know you said you're still rewriting, and you're. How does that go?
I've been meaning to do a book on acting for years and years and years, and I've had a little icon on my computer desktop called Why, and it wasn't about why write the book. It was because why was the essential idea behind the book, or behind my concept of acting. Is why do you do what you do, and once you have. Once you really know why you do what you do and want to do what you do, you'll do it. You'll do it really well. You'll remember your lines. You'll do the actions. You'll come alive. But if you're still doing it because the director said or the writer wrote it and you memorized it, blah, 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 you're apt to be flat. And anyway, that was kind of a central idea.
Interesting, interesting. Because I think a lot of times actors rely on their training, and they'll go in there with, they're thinking of just their training as opposed to what you just said about, but why? You know, you're really supposed to kind of forget that training once you really start getting, especially if they're very into like a Meisner or Strasberg, or they study with something that gets really, really deep and heavy, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, it's true. And I think it can distract and lead you down alleyways. That where I disagree with in my approach anyway with Meisner or with the other one will come back to me in a minute is they want you to memorize the lines before you start to work,
right?
And that's the absolute opposite of what I think you should do.
Really interesting.
And I have three don'ts in my book, and one of the don'ts is don't learn your lines. And my producer friend Bob Goodwin read that. He said, "Hey, wait a minute. What are you doing?"
Back it up.
So I had to qualify that. I didn't mean don't know your lines. I meant don't learn the lines. Oh. What you want to do is you want to figure out one way or another why you would want to say this way at this time. And that's fun to do. That's fun to explore that. That's exploring the character. Memorizing the lines, I will arise and go now, and go now to Innisfree, comma, and a small cabin build there of clay and wattles. You know, just trying to memorize text is boring. And I've seen actors just drive themselves crazy because this is what they have to do to get to the part they like. And my answer is, well, you don't have to do that at all. You can just start with the part you like, which is studying the character and studying what you're doing. And so,
So that's like the British technique, because I'm an actor as well, and I studied in New York with the British. She was trained in, you know, she was actually from America, but she studied in Great Britain for many years. And she also was a teacher, and she had a theater. And so she would always tell me, you know, the same kind of thing. The words, you're going to pull an emotion out of the word. The writing has to be good. That's number one. The writing sucks, and you're going to pull something that's not. And then you actually just, why are you saying these lines in the scene? What are you supposed to get through this scene? What is the purpose that you're here right now at this moment? Then go and see what you're supposed to say first, but first get that. She was very, very emphatic about that. And just make sure that you have a purpose to being in this scene.
Yeah. I mean, one of my favorite questions to an actor when I'm teaching or directing is, why do you say that? And, you know, they'll always usually answer it by explaining why it's true, whatever it was, the line was. But, you know, there's a lot of pictures on your wall, but you haven't said, oh, I have pictures on my wall today. You didn't want to say that today, even though it was true. Why did you say this that was true? And it probably wasn't true, because most things we say aren't true anyway. But
we're in the world of saying untruths.
Yeah. But going back to the evolution of the book, because the other thing I wanted to do was a kind of professional memoir of my life as an artist about acting, whether it was as an actor or a director or an acting teacher. But how did my life develop in that way? My first book is fun. But it goes a lot more into some things I probably shouldn't have said at all about my personal life. So I wanted to keep it quite professional. So I didn't know how to put this all together until I stumbled on Stephen King's book on writing.
Oh.
Which is in two parts, just as mine now is, because I copied this idea from him. The first part is his memoir of his life as a writer and what he went through, how he learned about writing in his life, in his biography, if you like. And the second half is what he thinks he knows about writing. And it's a kind of masterclass on writing. And so my book is a memoir of my life as an acting artist and a masterclass on acting, basically.
Wow.
That's
so cool. So when you're working with a new student, do you call them students? I don't know, sometimes people
sometimes you get to call them clients if they're more grown. If they're older, they're clients,
right? So when you're working with them, what's one of the first things that you actually are looking for in their either their presentation or their monologues or any conversations?
There's different ways of answering that. I mean, I'm always looking for them to be true. And what does that mean? It means they really want to say what they're saying, that they say it naturally. They don't play a tune on it. They don't act it. It's coming naturally from them. One of the exercises I often start with is I just put a cup on a table, on a chair in the middle of the room, and I say, come in, pick it up, and leave. That sounds pretty simple, right? It's not. They come in acting, here, I'm going to pick up my cup and leave. And then you put it back after the exercise is over, and it's perfect.
It is perfect.
When they're done. When they don't think they're acting anymore, they're just finishing it. And finding that kind of natural life is a key element.
Yeah.
Do you find that there are some people that just, you know, they'll come to you and they already have it and you just have to kind of fine tune what they have?
Yes, you do find that. It's people come at it different ways. You see, sometimes what I call the good student syndrome. Mm-hmm. The people who were really good at school and they got really good marks and they really work well and they figure it all out,
right.
And And then there's the bad student syndrome, who were terrible at school and whatever, and you come in and give them an acting thing, and boom, they blow you away.
Right.
They do it. And somehow you have to marry those two qualities.
Yes, exactly.
The one who blew you away probably wouldn't blow you away if you gave him a fixed text that he had to keep to on a regular basis. And he has to get some of what the good student could do, or the good student has to get some of what the bad student has, if you like. But,
I think there's talent. People are born with talent, but then there's the skill level that they have to develop.
Yeah.
And that's the part that if you don't dive into the skill, then you're because there is it. This is a technology in a sense. It is a science. It is something that's actually can be quantified pretty easily, when especially like through your book and through other classes, and you can see that there is something there that everyone is kind of striving for. What do you strive for when you and yourself, your own performances, are going for?
Well, I'm going for why. Mm-hmm. Why, you know, to be not, at least that's the preparation. I'm working on a play now. We're doing a production in Vancouver. It's a small production of Harold Pinter's No Man's Land.
Mm-hmm.
Which has some of the most complex text that you can find in Shakespeare. And so how do I approach that? I mean, finding out why I say all those things is what I have to do at this stage in the work. How this will come out, I don't know. I mean, I look at some performances that other actors have done, like Ian McKellen on the same role, and I go, what? Is that what he thought this character was about? I think that's where I'm going, but I don't know. We'll see where I go.
Right.
There's a comfort level, you'll know as an actor, there's a comfort level that you feel when it's really working, when you feel this is natural and it's happening and you're getting the right impulses and whatever. There's a terrible trap of habit. It's interesting, I mentioned in my book, because a Facebook friend recently posted this about seeing a dress rehearsal or a preview of a production of a Chekhov play at the Manitoba Theatre Centre and being just blown away. They thought this was just amazing and had amazing actors in it. As it happens, I saw that play 3 weeks later during its run.
It was
totally boring.
Wow.
Interesting.
And so the first question is, well, perhaps I'm a Philistine and I just couldn't see it. Or the second question is, this other person was just so impressed because of the names of the actors. But in retrospect, I think we were both right.
Mm-hmm.
I think in the preview, it was fresh. They were having the impulses. They were playing off each other. And by the time I saw it, it was in habit form.
Goes
into another part of the actor's brain.
Right. You
know, and it becomes on automatic. And that if it's a really plot-driven play, you can get away with it because the plot will carry you. But in Chekhov, which is so much character and human interaction, it just dies.
Yeah. But that's interesting because is that one of the reasons why, like, you'll have a play that runs 6 months, maybe a year, but they'll have to get new actors in to, because they want to keep things, you know, especially on Broadway, because, I mean, you know, you're doing 8 shows a week.
I know.
When you get down to that 8th show and you got to go again the next day, it's really difficult. Is there someone, I mean, I guess the director would be the one that you have to constantly be there to not only tweak whatever needed to be tweaked from the last 10 shows, but to kind of maybe say, we need more energy during this section.
Could you just quote that? Could you write that down and send it out?
Hold on.
And I'll tell you why. Because we're not allowed to do that anymore.
What?
Really?
In Canada, we are not allowed to do that. If we go back to see our production and it's whatever, and we have some notes. We have to give them to the stage manager, and the stage manager will give the notes to the actors. Good luck with that. Wow. We're not supposed to talk to them. Theoretically, we're not even supposed to say, good job, Joe, because that's directing them after the show's open and you're not working there anymore.
Wow. So is that like a union thing?
Exactly a union thing. It's exactly a union thing. And I think it got out of hand. I don't know what it's like in the U.S., whether they have this problem or not. But it's certainly here in Canada right now. And I think the stage management section of the union was stronger than the director section of the union. And wow. And I know there's an issue that they're can be concerned with, which is that a director gives notes to the actors and maybe even changes a move or two and doesn't tell the stage manager, and the stage manager doesn't know. Stage manager watches the show the next night and says, hey, you made a mistake here. You're not supposed to do that. They say, oh, well, William told me to do that. Well, I mean, you don't want
that. Well, you could see that. Yeah, you don't want that, but that's also, that's what a management is when you have a meeting, I guess, before every show, just a quick little powwow or something
to give the notes to the actors, the stage manager is present. At that.
Right. Right. Give everyone,
or whatever.
But CC everyone on the email.
I mean, it's workable. But exactly what you're saying. I've always done what you're saying. You know, it's go back and see my shows and give notes and things drift apart or things need to be brought together or new opportunities show themselves and you can make it even better. So.
Right. I can imagine like approaching, Brando and during his height and, trying to tell him how to direct. Did you ever have a really difficult actor that was,
I don't know if Brando was difficult with.
No, I don't think he was.
You get actors that are sensitive, we could say. Happens. But usually, if you have a good relationship, then they usually want to know what you think.
I spoke about this before about how theater today with the internet, you can really have. If you have that situation with the union and you have that kind of like the difficult, but you could really put a group together of, audition a nice group, start a company, get a little theater, and you can promote a lot of it online today for a lot cheaper than any other type of advertising. And I think that's the wonderful thing about theater, where these big theaters have all these big unions and these big kind of things that you can actually see, like off-Broadway shows in New York, which I've been to many, many times. You see some amazing shows. Yeah, off-Broadway, some incredible shows.
Absolutely.
And they're friends that just did it. They rented the space. Yeah. They sold their tickets. They promoted. And today with the internet, theater and even film to some degree. Film is a little bit more, a little more expensive in some areas, but I think it's just a wonderful thing to really consider moving into the future.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah,
George. Absolutely. Yes. Just really quick, talking about writing, I know you got a chance to write one of the episodes of The X-Files, right? How was that process for you? And I think I heard that they changed, they kind of changed a whole bunch of stuff by the time it got to the...
More union stuff?
Yeah.
Well, there's a whole bunch of things in that. I was fairly naive about their process when I suggested that I would like to write an episode, and they didn't really fill me in as well as they might have about their process, because they had this whole process where you board the script and the whole script department kind of meets and you map out the different sections of the script and blah, blah, blah. I blithely thought, a writer wrote a script and then you maybe worked on it after that.
Right.
So anyway, I wrote this script, it's a pretty funny script, but nobody's ever seen it except what's his name? Come back to me with the dramaturge at the time. And he really enjoyed reading it, but said, nope, that's not it. They didn't like my script. It involved a cigarette smoking man teaching Scully how to water ski.
Was that Chris Carter?
So anyway, but some of the essential ideas were still there. And then we did do this board thing. And then I went away and wrote another draft. And then we kind of worked on that. And then finally Chris wrote another draft.
Right.
And then something emerged that certainly some of what we wanted to say and some of what we wanted to do.
Okay.
And I think when you're writing for television, because remember, we're living in a different world, right, where you can just stream everything all the way through. You know, you had to have to write in different acts. You know, the first act, and then you got a commercial break, and then you come back. I remember, you know, shows like Law and Order in New York when I was in New York, and those type of shows, they had to have this first act be this long, so because they knew there was going to be a break, and then they had to be this act, and then the closing act.
Absolutely, yeah, right.
And today, that's sort of like not there anymore. It's kind of free now.
It feels like
it's a lot easier.
Yeah, yeah,
that's cool. Yeah. This has been we're at 50 minutes.
Wow.
We're almost at an hour.
My God. Amazing.
This has been such a great honor to have you on here. So much. I mean, I feel like we could just have a weekly show doing it. Yeah, this is great. So I just want to actually show your website where people can actually get your get the book. I'll just have it flashing there, and
it's also available on Amazon and really any other retailer. But
absolutely,
and this is what it looks like. Sorry, didn't mean to cut you out to block your face there with your own book. So before we let you go, I just want to, you know, we usually ask our guests during the last couple of years. We've had a little bit of a interesting time. A lot of artists were trying to figure out what they were going to do next. Some people made some big career choices. I moved to Nashville with my family. That was my big thing to move over here. And you know, what do you have some advice, some words of wisdom for some younger or not younger, you know, me, I'm not young, you know, just actors or performers for the next couple of, you know, years there of performing?
Well, as you know, the pandemic has been a problem, and it's been especially a problem in for small work, mm-hmm. you know, whether it's theater or a small film. Like the big productions here, they haven't stopped. Mm-hmm. They could afford to test everybody every day, practically every day, right. And so they could keep going. But the smaller productions, whether it's theater or film, couldn't do that. But hopefully we're through the worst of that. And you know, I think, well, I mean, I love what you talked about, you know, just friends getting together and putting together something and getting it on. I've seen some really nice work here doing that too. And you know, one of the things you say to someone who wants to be an actor, well, actually you could phrase the question differently. Do you want to be an actor or do you want to act? I mean, be an actor kind of suggests, you know, you're going to go to the Oscars and you're going to do all the actor things.
Right.
Suggests you're actually going to do the work, which is what you want to do. If you really want to do the work, go for it. Maybe you'll do it and you'll win an Oscar. Maybe you'll do all that. Maybe you'll do community theater. Maybe, but you can do the work. You can act if you want to act. So keep your motivation or your goals clear for yourself. To want to be famous is deadly, I think, and a lot of people want to be famous. And I guess there's ways to do that. But if you want to be an actor, if you want to join us in what we think of as an artistic pursuit, by all means, join us. But necessarily don't even expect to be famous. I mean, I became famous, but by accident, really. I was 53 before I started on the X-Files. You had heard of me before that. Well, people in Toronto had people that I was working.
Right.
But, I wasn't famous.
Yeah.
But I think that part of it's coming kind of like what you were talking about as far as learning lines and that type of thing. And why are you, learning those lines? Why, and you knowing why, that why. So the same thing could be said for the artist. Why do you want to become an actor? What exactly. What is it? Is it because you want that fame, or is it because you really love the craft and you'll just do it even if you're not making a ton of money, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And I think as I heard Dustin Hoffman say once at the Acting Center interview, where he said he'd be doing it right now no matter what happened. He said, and then he quoted, I think it was Picasso, who said, if you take away my paints, I'll use my pastels. If you take away those, if you take away everything, I would spit on my finger and I would paint on the wall with my own saliva because I have to do it. And he said the same thing, Dustin Hoffman, and he would still be doing it, if he didn't get that break. He was doing a car commercial and then he gets, Mrs. Robinson.
The
graduate, yeah.
The graduate, yeah.
The graduate, like literally right afterwards, right? So it's like, So, I mean, it was just the way it happens, But those are wonderful words. I want to thank you for your time and for all your wisdom. I hope you please come back and tell us, give us more.
This has been just a ton of fun. So
thank you so much.
Come back anytime. I love it.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. All right.
We'll be right back with you. Wow.
That was awesome. See, what I mean, that's the kind of thing that I want to be able to just talk to for 2 or 3 hours, that kind of conversation.
Maybe we need to extend the show.
I think so, but who's going to stay with us for 2 hours?
I know, exactly.
You have to bribe them. But all right. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in. Appreciate it. William B. Davis, that was awesome. Don't forget, check out his book right there on acting and life. And I'm definitely getting my copy, and I'm going to get it today. I'm going to order it right as soon as I get off of here. But I want to thank you all for tuning in. We'll see you all again next week, same time, 7 p.m. Central, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Counterparts. George Bautista, John Henry Soto, have a wonderful evening. And as always, peace.